FA Writers. We're always so happy to have you here. I hope you all are enjoying the holiday season and the first couple days of 2024. The pod team is taking a break for a little winter vacation, so we've got a re-release for you today of my interview with Kayla Cayasso. Shout out to Kayla, who just finished the first semester of her PhD program. The podcast will be back soon with new episodes. Until then, you can find MFA Writers on Instagram and Twitter, as well as mfawriters.com. We love to hear from listeners, so feel free to shoot us a direct message on one of those platforms, or an email at mfawriterspodcast@gmail.com. And if you have a minute to rate or review the show, the best place to do that is on Apple Podcasts. Doing so will help boost our podcast as we try to boost these amazing writers. Also, if you or someone you know would like to be a guest on the show, you can apply at mfawriters.com. On that same website, you can also click the support button to support us financially, if it's within your means. Or you can do so by going directly to buymeacoffee.com/mfawriters. Finally, as always, thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoyed the episode. Welcome to MFA Writers, the podcast where we talk to creative writing MFA students about their program, their process, and a piece they're working on. I'm your host, Jared McCormick. Today, I'm with Kayla Cayasso. Kayla is an Afro-Latina writer and poet from North Florida. She is a recipient of the 2012 Hollins Creative Writing Book Award and the Florida A&M University Graduate Feeder Fellowship, and she placed first in fiction in the 2021 FAMU Annual Writing Contest. Her writing has been published in Cake Literary Journal, Olit Magazine, The Amistad, River and South Review, and many other places. Kayla just graduated from the University of Central Florida with an MFA in fiction. Today she's going to read an excerpt from a short story titled Awful.
Thanks, Jared. So this is an excerpt from a short story. The piece is set in 1934. Pauline thought the silence in the truck once she hit the paved part of US 17 would bring her some peace, but she could feel her blood boiling under her blistered hands as the truck sailed smooth over the road beneath. Or maybe that was because the sighing sun, only just beginning to descend, was still high enough to leap through the pines and beat down on her. Pauline couldn't know the time, but she knew it would be six soon. That meant B's train from Tallahassee would be pulling in soon. It had taken weeks of convincing through letters to get her daughter to postpone catching the connecting train for a last night on the Montgomery homestead. At the thought of her daughter looking around the station and thinking no one had come to meet her, Pauline upshifted to third and pressed the gas to the floor. She'd told Eustace that Mr. Humphreys was no mechanic. The old man still used a mule and buggy, for Christ's sake. She'd asked to look at the truck herself if they couldn't afford a professional in the city. At least she'd grown up using mechanical reapers. But useless Eustace would hear nothing of it, and Pauline suspected it was because Norm Humphreys had that dirty, home-cooked heroin that always left her head pounding and her hands shaking. Pauline blinked away the coming migraine, gripped the wheel tight to keep the shakes at bay. She didn't know what had been said between Eustace and his brother, but whatever it was had left her husband with a spoiled attitude and readied hands. He'd snapped, struck her with the back of his hand when she asked when Judge and Virgie would be by for the pickin'. She ran her tongue over her swollen, freshly split lip and could still taste the whisper of iron. When Pauline first heard the stories about the so-called Mad Montgomerys, they'd been only murmurs floating between the well-dressed church ladies of Amelia Island's New Macedonia AME. Murmurs about a girl from the family who left her two boys on her parents' pig farm. The girl had woken before the sun and taken off into the low-hanging mist between Yulee and Jacksonville, never seen again. Where she went or why she left, no one could say. Every time one of those Montgomery boys got into trouble, though, the talk would start up again. Some said she ran off to be with the father of her sons. Others said she hopped on a train north and folded herself into the mass of people migrating that way. And still others said the fog itself had picked her up and carried her away from the horrible place she came from, where her daddy drank like a fish and her insane mama would whip her senseless with azalea switches. Abby Montgomery's name became a warning from women to their daughters. Don't be out there running in them streets. You'll wind up like that Abby Montgomery. She remembered the local legends about Abby as she'd grown up, and that was why Pauline went about securing her first husband the right way. Sure, she'd gotten pregnant before they were really married, but she had always been ready to be a wife, even if Wilmer Bowman's temper boiled too hot sometimes. But marriage and surely fatherhood changed a man. And it had. Where arguments used to end in screaming matches, they now ended with Wilmer dragging her by her hair to their room, where he'd beat her until her vision turned blurry. Marriage changed her too. Pauline learned to avoid arguments. While pregnant, Pauline would think about the fabled Abby Montgomery and wonder if the fog that hung across Amelia Island in the early mornings could take her someplace far away too, away from the baby she was cooking up that would tie her to Wilmer forever. But when she gave birth to Bee, perfect, perfect Bee, Pauline did away with that idea. To leave like Abby Montgomery? No. A mother did not leave her children. Ever. Even if some babies never took a breath. If their eyes never opened. If all there was to prove they'd ever existed were the three water-smoothed stones on the west side of Little Lee Creek, basking under the magnolias beside their mad great-grandmother, Ada Mae Montgomery.
Kayla, that was wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing that with us and for being here today.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you. And as I mentioned in your bio, you just graduated with your MFA from Central Florida. So first off, congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
A big relief.
Yes, yes. It was a big process that I had not expected myself to undertake. And now being on this side of it, it is a relief. And also, like, you know, you're coming to terms with not doing it anymore.
Yeah, yeah. It's an accomplishment, but also a transition for sure. Well, having just graduated, that means you also just finished your thesis, which you told me is a historical fiction collection titled Save the Drowning Child. I assume the piece you just read is from that collection. Do you mind telling us about that project?
Yeah, so the collection, as I was developing how I really wanted the stories to be linked, I kept finding myself coming back to what I was really used to writing as a young writer when I would have been like 11 to like 18. I was really writing a lot of historical stories. I was really into history documentaries. And that was not what I intended when I came to the program to come back to that. But it ended up being really cathartic, almost like putting on this like really comfy sweater that I hadn't worn in a long time. And then writing about my hometown just came to it very naturally. So it ended up being a collection of 5 short stories and 1 Pecha Kucha, which is a 110-line poem. And the short stories take place from, I think the earliest is what would be like the 1690s, with the latest taking place in 1960.
What do you think motivated that interest in history and writing historical fiction?
You know, I think it was when I was younger, I was really like focused on writing about topical things. I remember writing often about like World War II, and I often wrote about like the fallout from the Holocaust. And when I was coming to this project, I came with the intention of like writing more about like my cultural experience rather than a cultural experience I shouldn't be engaging in if I don't have that like background. But I was really interested in the way we are so much the same across time. A lot of my characters are characters who are not self-aware and who do really heinous things. I don't tend to write these happy stories, unfortunately. Yeah. but I am fascinated by this idea that, like, you know, these people are often people who are not necessarily victims of circumstance, but they are certainly victims of generations of circumstances being against them. And I really wanted to explore, what does it look like to zoom in on a family or a couple or a child who is at the end of generations of trauma and generations of cultural genocide, of physical genocide, and see them try to navigate the world that they're in. And I didn't want my pieces to be really didactic. I wanted them to feel real, like real lived issues. And people who don't have the language skills or the access to be able to understand what's happening to them, or to be able to understand how their response is in response to these generational issues that are going on around them.
It's so easy to, like, look back and think about historical events or time periods and think about the people as not real people. Maybe this is just me, but, like, I feel such a disconnect from, like, people who went through, like, World War II. They almost feel like not real to me. And that was, like, pretty recent, right? I mean, so going back as far as you're going, it just feels so removed. So I love the idea of focusing in on the character and, like, exploring who the people were and exploring how they're very similar to us, just in a different time.
Yeah, it is. When I stepped back from the project, I was really surprised by how often I was writing about the same kind of dynamic. But, you know, eventually that becomes, like, what I am doing. Yeah. You know, you sat there, you're like, oh, I'm doing this thing. I'm writing about mothers. I'm writing about gender struggles. So then you lean into that. But yeah, it was really, really exciting for me to turn what is often what we often disconnect from historically into something that feels so emotionally connected to us.
You received your bachelor's in African American studies from Florida A&M University in 2021 before pursuing the MFA. How much does that educational background affect the writing you do today? And what was your motivation in pivoting to creative writing after undergrad?
As far as influencing my work now, as far as the thesis, it deeply influenced my work. I think being educated in the social sciences first helped me grasp this project, this historical fiction project, a lot more easily. I understood how to access and do research through, like, public documents. It became a lot more accessible to me because I'd been taught how to do it and been taught systems that worked for me when I was in my bachelor's. And then on top of that, some of my stories feature a lot of what I studied in my undergrad program. I did a term paper in undergrad about a high school in Jacksonville, where I'm from, called Stanton College Prep, where I graduated from in 2012, which is a historically Black high school. And that features in several of my stories, understanding, like, these important figures who came through that school and the way the school influenced the town, and the way that influence has shifted from when my characters would be going and attending as young Black children to me in 2012 walking the school, was a really exciting experience, and a kind of catharsis and a kind of, like, opening up. It was like peeling back petals of a flower to, like, get to something that was in the center. It was really fascinating. And as far as switching and pivoting from social sciences to creative writing, I actually always kind of knew I wanted to study creative writing. I was never, like, 100% sure that it was the right decision, but I knew I wanted to do it. But when I came to FAMU, I found that they didn't have a creative writing program. The best that I could do at FAMU at the time was a writing minor, which was like a catch-all, anything goes. There was technical writing, rhetoric, literature, linguistic courses, as well as creative writing courses. All of this fit into this minor. And so it was really like a grab bag. And it really was some of the professors. There were only three creative writing professors. To my knowledge, there are still only three now at FAMU. And I took both fiction and poetry. And it was my poetry professor who I talked to and told her I'm thinking of going to graduate school. And she asked me, you know, what are you planning on studying? And I told her this, I'm trying to do this right here. I want to try to keep going and see what happens when I get into higher level courses. Because I just found I wasn't getting the feedback I really wanted to grow as a writer in these non-major specific courses. And she, Christine Snodgrass, bless her to like infinity. She on the spot gave me a position on the school magazine. She involved me really deeply in like the literary happenings in Tallahassee. She gave me all of the resources I needed to start searching for schools. And it was really through her and my fiction professor at FAMU, Rafael Gamero, that I really felt like, oh my gosh, this is no longer an idea. This is a thing I can actually grasp and do. And that decision to apply from that conversation with Christine to my application was maybe like 3 months. It was a very quick process. And it just, I sort of like threw it on the table, sent in my application, said, you know, if I don't get in, it's a numbers game and I can always apply next year. And so I might as well also apply for other master's programs, which I did do. And I was beyond stunned when I was accepted to UCF. So it was a very serendipitous series of events that got me here.
Cool. That's so exciting. You told me that you were drawn to storytelling at a young age, but for a long time you actively avoided writing stories about characters who looked like you. But that changed when you attended the MFA. What made you avoid those characters before, and why did you decide to make a change during the MFA?
Yeah, like I was a big reader as a child, as I'm sure all of us were. And I read a lot with my mom, who is Black, and she read with me. We picked out books together. We would read the same books. It was like a book club of two.
Yeah.
And we never read books about Black girls. And it was not something that I was like, why aren't we doing this? My thought instead was they don't write books about Black girls. People don't want to read books about Black girls. And there aren't Black people who want to do that either. That was my impression. And for a very long time, I realized the error in that impression, but it certainly stuck as I went into my writing classes in high school, where I was actively choosing not to do that. I thought that if I started to write stories about Black girls, about Latinas, about fat girls, about girls who look like me, I didn't think that people would like my writing as much. And I was very ego-fed at that point in my writing process. I was very much hanging on to the compliments and the praise of my work, and I did not want to lose that.
I don't think you're particularly unique in that when it comes to writers.
Yeah. We are all tiny egomaniacs, and it's a good thing we're in creative work.
We need that praise to keep us going.
Yeah. And, you know, I thought if I started writing about people who looked like me, that would go away. And when I came to the MFA, there was, by that time, I think my scholarship at FAMU had helped me unlearn a lot of these like self-hating thoughts and just processes of going about my life. And I feel like I'd unlearned a lot of that by the time I was entering the MFA. And so I made the decision, you know, every story I write is going to be about brown people living their lives. It's not going to be about, you know, Black people living through slavery, and it's not going to be about Latina people living through the revolution. It's going to be about their daily lives and what it really feels like to operate in these spaces, and what these families look like. I wanted it to feel graspable and real, and again, like not didactic. And I knew I had the factual information now to back up what I was writing from my undergraduate studies. So I just made the decision, you know, everything I write, whether it's good or bad, I want to write about people who look like me.
Well, that's beautiful. Thank you for sharing that with us. And besides writing black and brown characters, you told me as a writer, you also want to subvert traditionally white spaces and genres like Southern Gothic and diversify the Southern lit tradition. And you told me that part of this motivation came from a Southern and Appalachian literature class you took. Can you tell us about that class and how it motivated this focus in your work?
Yeah, absolutely. So I took this Southern and Appalachian Lit class, which was a special contemporary literature studies class. It's not offered every semester. It was developed and apparently in the works for a little while by a professor who went on to be my thesis director, David James Poisson at UCF, who is from the Southern area, the Southern region. And he reads and writes Southern literature. So I took this class in spring of my first year. The first book we read was Burning Bright by Ron Rash. And it was like reading exactly what I'd been trying to do on some level. Like, I opened the book, read the collection, and at the end of each story, I was like, this is what I am trying to do. It was like I hadn't known it until I read that collection.
It's a beautiful moment when that happens.
Oh, yes. It was like the skies opened, like birds singing. It just started to make sense. Yeah. That like I saw that how important place was, not just as far as it being this backdrop that characters like stand in front of, like a stage play. It was more than that. Like, I saw how it impacted characters' psychology. I saw how the setting was impacting actual things in these characters' lives. Issues with poverty and religion and drug abuse and substance use. And all of these things that I was seeing in Ron Rash's collection felt so familiar. And I am not from the Appalachian region by any means. I have not spent time there. But being from North Florida, people are often surprised that I describe it as the South. And it was that book that really made me feel like my hometown and my writing has a place within this Southern literature conversation. And I can prove it to people. I know that I can prove it to people in conjunction with like my undergraduate work that I did, studying this region, studying the Florida region, specifically the North Florida region I came from. I knew I could do it, and I knew it needed to be done, especially reading a couple of Florida lit books in that class that were on the syllabus that I felt like just almost missed the mark, that felt like a nebulous kind of Florida, whereas Ron Rash's places felt so clear. The Florida that I saw in some of the Florida lit books that we read felt very fuzzy and unclear. And I really wanted to try, if I could, to bring a little bit more to that Florida picture and like show people how it fits into this Southern literature landscape.
Well, I want to talk a bit about your process, because we don't get many historical fiction writers on the podcast, and I'm curious to hear how you generate, draft, and revise the stories you write. So let's start at the beginning. I assume with historical fiction, there's a fair amount of research that goes into writing a piece, probably before you ever put a word on the page. What kind of research do you do when planning a piece?
So I think you might get, I'm sure you'd get different answers if you ask different people, but my opinion on research is that it starts around often kitchen tables. It starts often in conversations with your ancestors, your parents, and their grandparents, where you hear a story that doesn't quite pan out, and you're like, I know there's something there. And that same feeling is what happened to me when I came into my undergraduate studies. I was learning how to do research. You read something, and you're like, there is more here to this. And maybe that more here is just the process of trying to get closer and create someone, a character in this situation who has lived through this. And what might they think? As far as my own research, I found myself doing a lot of dives into public records. I used a lot of old maps. I used a lot of old photographs. I already knew sort of I knew I wanted to focus on the 20th century. And looking for stories that sort of crept across the 20th century that gave me that feeling of there's more to this story that people are either not saying because they don't know, that it's been not talked about for so long, or they do know, and it is more about saving face and presenting a certain way. But I want to try to not guess, but extrapolate what someone in this situation might have gone through, what someone with these sets of things happening to them might do in response. So as far as my research, it was like an ongoing process. Like I found at some points I was certainly over-researching, and that research process was kind of keeping me from starting the draft or in the revision process. It was really keeping me in one case in particular, it was really keeping me from revisioning my story, like reimagining my story by holding too tightly to the factual research. Like there were certainly times I had to like step back and be like, I am writing fiction. I can write what I need to write to tell the story I need to tell. And the research is just going to be something that enhances that for me. I don't need to, in these cases, stick or adhere so deeply to the facts of my research. So that was like an issue I had often coming from a social science background where it's, you don't make up facts, you know?
Right.
And that's what we're doing, you know? So it was a transition. There was a certain like push and pull to knowing when I've researched enough and knowing when I might need to take a break and do more research.
Okay. So you've mentioned that a lot of your stories are very character driven. I can imagine the ways in which you might integrate research into the settings and the timelines and even the plots of a story. But how do you use research to get at a character in your story?
So a lot of my research for characters is actually, it's actually come from conversations with people. There is a story in my collection where I spoke with a friend who was also from Florida, a different part of Florida, but she described to me this time her mother sat her down and told her about how as an infant, her mother would hide from her for hours and just let her cry and not go to her, not check on her. And I remember hearing that and thinking that this is something that a lot of people will have a visceral reaction to, one way or another, whatever you think about it. And I wanted to try to understand how someone can do this, not like through this judgmental lens, but literally what drives a person to do this thing. And I found myself, when I was crafting characters, I found myself really building on a lot of those moments that I've had with friends, stories from their family, stories from my own family. Where I really questioned, like, what was this person thinking to say this, to treat their family member this way, or to say this thing to this person? So when it came to my character, a lot of that research was really interpersonal research. It really had to do with, like, my memories of my family, my friends' families and their experiences. I pulled really, really deeply from my own experiences with my siblings, my grandmother, stories from my mother's family, to build out these characters, not necessarily their personalities, but to flesh out the situations that these characters create for themselves.
And I imagine historical context could help to answer those questions of why a character does something that they do, right?
Exactly. It becomes this unspoken nuance throughout some of the stories that readers might read and say, wow, in this situation, someone who is a child bride at 15 in the 1900s, yeah, I can see why they might leave their child crying for hours and hours when they themselves are only 15, 16 years old. So it becomes this process of like getting my readers to think about history and the impact of history on my characters a bit more deeply.
Well, I imagine not every program would be well suited for someone doing the work that you are doing. So I'm curious to hear about your experience in the MFA at the University of Central Florida, a 2-year partially funded program with tracks in fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. What was it that drew you to Central Florida?
Well, I actually have a little bit of history with UCF. I went to UCF for a couple years in undergrad, and I had to take some time off and step away. And so as far as figuring out where I wanted to go in the application process, it was really the deciding factor was where I would be comfortable living for 2 years. I was coming from Tallahassee, which was a very small town in comparison to what I was expecting of Tallahassee. And that ended up having its own difficulties. Like I ended up having my own set of difficulties with living in a smallish town like that. And so I was really excited to be in a space where I didn't feel so many eyes on me. And Orlando was a town I knew. I had family here. I grew up in Jacksonville and came to Orlando all the time as a child. So I was really comfortable with the area. But as far as the program, I really liked a lot of the course listings that I saw from the past. I really liked that there were hybrid workshops, and it looked like we would be able to dip into those hybrid workshops and I'd be able to keep writing poetry, which at FAMU, I was really only starting to work on more heavily. I ended up taking more poetry classes at FAMU than I did fiction classes. So I was excited to try to keep doing that. I was seeing the impact that had on my fiction writing. So it was really like a decision of like, where would I be okay living? Where would be most familiar and comfortable for 2 years as I go through the grad school struggle that we're all going through? And how much leeway do I have with what I can write? I was used to being told you can't write genre, and historical fiction in those courses was genre. So I was really excited to have some space and breathing room as far as what I wanted to write.
And did you feel like there were faculty members at the University of Central Florida who were able to help you develop as a writer of historical fiction?
I think that when I brought my historical fiction thesis proposal to my thesis director, I didn't know him to be a historical fiction writer. I don't know anyone on the staff necessarily to be a historical fiction writer. But I did see them doing things with their work that I knew I wanted to do with my work. And when I brought the thesis proposal for historical fiction to my director, his focus was really on place. And trying to nail down like tone, place, and not just physical place, but temporal place also. And he was really helpful in helping me figure out how to think about place in a broader sense. And also in like a more intimate sense, where I was coming from my undergrad thinking about place as a very like sort of static thing. He really helped me figure out how I can link like my character psychology and the psychic distance I'm using with my narrative to place as a living, breathing, evolving thing. So my thesis director was fabulous for this, but there were not staff members who particularly worked in that genre.
Well, as we've talked about, you came from more of a history-focused interdisciplinary program as an undergraduate. I imagine the transition into this more creative space must have had its ups and downs. So what was that transition like for you, and what were some of the challenges?
It was a rough transition. I remember for one course, it was like a professional development course that all first years are required to take. And we were talking about like mastheads. And I remember sitting in the classroom, there were only like 8 of us in the class, and everyone's answering questions that my professor is asking. And I remember sitting there thinking like, what is a masthead? Like I was losing my mind. I was really nervous. I didn't have that kind of language. I didn't know the terminology. So I often felt at a disadvantage, or I felt like when I opened my mouth to say something, like I was kind of stating the obvious. But I have always been the student who like, I'm going to answer even if I don't know if what I'm saying is right. So that helped propel me through some of that. But what really helped me, I think, was the community in the classroom. I think that's what ultimately helped me. People were really responsive when I had things to say. And I could tell I was bringing a perspective that maybe they weren't familiar with. And certainly they had a perspective that I wasn't familiar with, but they seemed interested in that perspective. And so that was really, really helpful. I don't know that I would have been as willing to keep talking and nervously answering questions if I had a less friendly group of people to be in the class with. And as far as transitioning into this creative space, I feel like as I ended my first year, I was really starting to understand how my background was bringing me a strength in diversity. It brought me a diversity of thinking that I could tell some of my peers did not have. And I think that was helpful to me and just another small ego boost of being like, oh, this kind of sets you apart and makes you think about things slightly differently. And that might be something that you can leverage. So yeah, it was a rocky transition, but I feel like by the end of the first year, I was really being wrapped in this community, and that was deeply helpful.
Yeah, well, I want to talk just a bit more about that community, because according to the program website, the MFA program accepts 15 to 20 new students each year, meaning there are 30 to 40 students in the program at any given time. That's a fairly big program, and I imagine one benefit of being in a bigger program is that there are probably other students who you can depend on in times of struggle. How was the sense of community in the program?
You know, I think if you're in an MFA program or even thinking about an MFA program, I think something important to remember is that we're all weird. We're all strange. We all have like weird niche things we're into, and we all think about things in a weird way. And that was really helpful to me as I was trying to get to know people. It was really helpful to me as I was trying to feel at home, to know that like I was with my camp. Like, these are the people who I think are weird. They think I'm weird, but we get it. We get each other. And we get what it is we're trying to do for the most part. Overwhelmingly, the community was nothing but positive. I was really afraid of coming into the program. And, you know, I came in with the mentality of knowing that, you know, these are my peers, but these are also my competition in some respects. And I think we all know that, but more than that, I think we think of each other as professional peers. We can reach out to each other throughout the course of our career, not just these 2 years in the program. And we all just want to see each other succeed. To know someone who got a story published is exciting to even know them. So it was just, I couldn't have asked for like, honestly, a better group of people to be in the program with. My cohort is just full of really talented people who just care about creating and having all of us be successful. So there was never that, not a whole lot of contention or anything like that between students as far as like, oh, who's going to be placed in the best magazine and who's going to get the best internship. We really shared these opportunities. Like, we would email each other and share in our Discord, our group me, you know, this is an opportunity I think would be good for you, and you should look at this internship. And it was just constantly that kind of energy. And, you know, there are small maybe tiffs between people, but overwhelmingly, we all want each other to succeed. So I was really, really relieved by the community I came into.
I mentioned that the program has tracks in fiction, nonfiction, and poetry, but the website also mentions several times that they're open to and encouraging of hybrid and experimental forms. Were you able to experiment or take classes in cross-genre writing while you were in the program?
Yeah, I had the opportunity to take two what's called multi-genre workshops. And these are workshops that blend nonfiction and poetry. These can take the shape of whatever the poet or writer perceives these things to be. So I was able to read a lot of personal essays, a lot of small memoir essays. I was able to write lyric essays and work on form and read a lot of poetic form that I was not used to reading from undergrad, and think about those craft elements and these genres more deeply than some of my peers who did not do the multi-genre workshops. And there were good reasons to not do the multi-genre workshops. Having two workshops in one graduate semester was a lot. But I do feel like I gained so much from that process. I was coming to the MFA with more like formal education in poetry than I was in fiction. And I think that I ended up seeing the results of that on the line level of my work as I continued through the program. I saw myself thinking about sound differently and thinking about white space and negative space really differently in my fiction. Then I feel like maybe some people were thinking about it without having that exposure to poetics and nonfiction writing. So I encourage people to read across genre. It's only going to make your writing better.
Yeah, I also went to an interdisciplinary program where we had the opportunity to take classes in other genres. I write fiction, but I also found that taking workshops in nonfiction and poetry really helped my fiction a lot. So I also encourage listeners to do that. And you also mentioned before the interview that some of this cross-genre work influenced your teaching as well. What kinds of classes did you teach while in the program, and how did you find the skills you were learning affected how you taught?
So I taught two sections of creative writing for English majors. And as far as the hybrid work influencing my teaching, I found myself a lot more confident talking about poetry and nonfiction than I would have otherwise been. When it came to having these conversations with my students about, who came with great questions, like, how do you know a poem is a poem? And I remember they would love to ask me this question. And I remember my answer, which I'm sure they got tired of, was always, isn't that the whole question? Isn't that the entire thing we're here to try to figure out? Which they hated. But I think it got them to the place where they were more comfortable thinking about what they were doing as poetry rather than thinking about what they were doing as an assignment for their poetry unit. Students who openly told me, like, I hate poetry, I've never written it, I don't see any value in it, ended the semester saying, you know, I think I'm going to keep working on my poetry and try to submit it to a few places. I think exposing them to all of these different forms, I ended up teaching poetry through forms, which at first they did not like, but I think they were able to see forms as another craft element, whereas before they were really seeing, I think, form as poetry and nothing else. And giving them a sort of scaffolding to build poetry when some of them had never even read poetry, I think made it a lot more accessible to them to read blackout poetry, look at asemic poetry, look at long forms and short forms, look at experimental poetry. I think all of these options gave them a more accessible grasp to just even read poetry, even if they never pick up a pen to write a poem again. I think they left my class understanding that poetry can be more accessible than sort of puzzle, like figuring out, like, it's not necessarily the process of figuring out a puzzle. Writing an essay is not argumentative or expository. You can write whatever it is you want to write and use these craft elements in that process.
The best I can tell from the website, the MFA program at Central Florida is not a fully funded program. It seems there are several scholarships and fellowships available in addition to teaching positions like the one you had. Do you have any sense of how many students in the program are funded?
So most students come into the program with some kind of funding. There are several fellowships that get awarded out first, and they separate these out into fiction funding, and then poetry and nonfiction are grouped together, and that funding. So these are like fully funded fellowships. And then there are options for assistantships that are handed out to first years. And then if you do not get assistantships, like being a GTA, there is the option to take a course that is basically learning how to teach composition. Most GTAs teach comp rather than creative writing. And so you can take this course and then interview for a position as a GTA for your second year. So there's an option if you don't receive funding for the first year where you can possibly get funding for the second year. But for the most part, most of us are funded in some kind of way.
Okay. Well, good information for listeners to know if they're thinking about it. And, you know, always important to ask whoever the person is you're communicating with from the program, ask them about funding and the different ways that you can get it, and definitely pursue those avenues, because usually schools have more money than they let on at first.
Absolutely.
I also wanted to take some time to talk about some of the additional opportunities available through the program. For one, students in the program have the chance to work at the Florida Review. Have you or anyone you've known had the chance to work there?
Oh, yeah. Several of my peers and classmates work at the Florida Review and have done work for the Florida Review. There are GTA positions for the Florida Review that are assigned. And there's often a course specifically for editing for literary journals, which is for credit, but you also work with the Florida Review through that course. Then there are volunteer readers who, if you just kind of want to dip your toes, you're not really sure if you want the load of deciding who gets published, you can be a reader for the Florida Review. And several people in the program are readers for the Florida Review. And then outside of the graduate level, for those who are still in undergrad, there is also opportunities as an undergrad to work with the Florida Review. So it's not a student magazine, but it's ran by students. It is deeply ingrained into the curriculum, if you want it to be. I have not had the opportunity to work for the Florida Review. I spent most of my graduate program working for The Dodge, which is a literary magazine based out of Worcester College. They publish writing about animals and eco-fiction. So I did not work for the Florida Review, but I do know that the quality of editors that they have in the program is phenomenal. The quality of editors in the Florida Review staffing is just really, really superb. And the process of like working on the Florida Review, I think, is really good experience for people really wanting to figure out the ins and outs of submissions on the back end. Like, what does it look like on the inside?
Yeah, the Florida Review is a great journal, and I always recommend if you have a chance to work at a literary magazine, do it, because I personally learned so much from reading submissions and just watching what I was looking for as a reader and then applying that to my own work was super helpful. Additionally, the Graduate Writers Association is a student-led group at UCF, which brings two visiting writers to campus each year and hosts several social and professional events, including Parcels, a monthly reading series that you said was one of your favorite parts of the program. So tell us about that.
Yeah. So while I was in the program, I was the vice president of the Graduate Writers Association, and we organized Parcels as a way to get our MFA students to interact with the community and get practice reading. So we have switched venues several times over the course of Parcels history. I think it's been running since 2013 or 2011, something like that. And while I was with the GWA, we started our Parcels readings first at Zeppelin Books, which is located in downtown Orlando and owned by a student in the MFA program who also recently graduated. So he opened that space for us to be able to be surrounded by books, surrounded by local authors, and just create a really insular space for us to both interact with the community, but also a safe place for those who are maybe not as practiced in reading aloud, to have space to begin doing that. We shifted in the second, in my second semester of the last year. So around January of this past year, we began doing our Parcels readings at Binks. So each student reads for 10 minutes from any selections of work that they would like. We also always have a faculty reader to close out. So it is very low stakes. And the way I liked to pitch it to students who were maybe a bit nervous about being asked to read was, you know, this is going to be good practice for when you are a big best-selling New York Times author and you need to do readings on the Oprah show. This is going to be great practice. But it was just always a good time. It was great to get to know the community a bit more. We always had people come up to us, like either at intermission or after Parcels, to say, like, what is this? What is it you guys are doing? a lot of people, you know, loved the stories they heard. Some people maybe didn't like their Sundays interrupted with reading, but it was always a good time. It was always fun, and it was a great opportunity to get to see what people outside of your genre are working on. Because if you're not someone who's opting to take those multi-genre courses, you're likely never going to hear the poetry of your peers who are in the poetry genre, or the essays that people are writing in nonfiction. And this is a chance to be able to get everyone in the same place with the same goal and be able to see the talent you're surrounded by and get to know these people through their work. It sort of demystifies your peers for you to be able to see them read their work.
Yeah, it sounds so much fun. And those kind of things are so great for building community, not only in the program, but in like the greater area around the university. So I love that. Well, before we go, I want to give you the last word. What is one way in which the MFA experience has been different, for better or for worse, from your expectations when applying?
I was in the program, and when I came into the program, I made that decision to write people who look like me, and I was not prepared for how much I would have to fight for that in workshop. I mean, I really, there was never any times where I was challenged by faculty or anything like that. I was always supported by faculty. But I remember my first workshop in the program was a story about a Latina woman who is feeling pressures of needing to get married and start a family. And that anxiety manifests in an eyeball that appears on the back of her hand. And I remember one of the first notes I received in workshop was the fact that she was Latina was distracting and had nothing to do with the story, and that I should remove everything about her being Latina from the story. And I was really surprised to hear that. And then I was even more surprised that nobody said anything about that note, that just passed with no comment and no challenge. And that was certainly not the norm. I was not getting that every workshop, you know. So I don't want people to think that that's just how workshops are run at UCF. I did not experience that as an ongoing problem. But I remember in that moment feeling like I need to fight for this if this is what I'm deciding to do. So how much I needed to fight for it and clarify what it was I was trying to do surprised me, mostly because I wasn't coming from a workshop heavy environment. I was not majoring in creative writing. I did not major in English. I was coming from the social sciences, surrounded by people who looked like me at an HBCU. So that was a slight culture shock as I came to the MFA program at UCF. But on the flip side, what really surprised me, again, was just how much community was there to back me up when I really did need to be backed up, when I really needed to be reminded that, like, I'm doing something that has importance and has value, even if it's only to me. That was there when I ended up needing it to be there. And I was really lucky to be in that place with these people who overwhelmingly were just people trying to get by like I was, trying to also do the same thing I was as far as, you know, write something that's important, even if it's only important to me and the person I show this to tomorrow. So I would say that for those thinking about this process and like trying to apply, or maybe on their a second or third round of applications, if you know this is what you want to do and you know that your writing, you want your writing to have some importance to it, it already does, number one. And number two, there are other people out there who are going to read it in these programs and also think that that's what you're doing. They're going to see what you're doing and understand it. There will be people who don't, but there will 100% be people who do.
Well, I'm glad that you fought for your work, and I hope you continue to fight for it because it sounds like beautiful, important work, and I can't wait to read more of it. Thank you so much for stopping by and chatting with me today. This was great.
Thank you so much. I hope you have a great rest of your day.